Welcome back to Across the Movie Aisle, presented by the Rebeller Podcast Network. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch, the editor-in-chief of Rebeller, and I survived the coronavirus, or possibly strep, I'm not a doctor. I am joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
Maintaining?
I'm in my apocalypse bunker slash recording studio, so fine.
Good. Before we get started with the show, I wanted to fill our loyal listeners in on a special promo we are running as our nation enters lockdown mode. For a limited time, you can get 2 months of access to everything at rebellermedia.com for free. That's not a nothing Zippo free. The bad news is you're locked away at home. The good news is, if you click on that originals tab up at the top of the site, we have a treasure trove of content for you to sift through. I would start with the original Outlaws series by Jacob Q. Knight. He always highlights a ton of movies. And the Profiles in Badass series by Outlaw Verne, who will take you through, amongst others, the work of Jean-Claude Van Damme. All sorts of good stuff. So there's tons and tons to watch while you're locked away in your bunker / podcast studio. Each essay we'll provide you with weeks of lockdown entertainment. It'll be great. We are paying good people good money for the content you're enjoying, including the content you're enjoying right now. And we hope you will sign up for a membership, which will give you unlimited access. After the free period ends, it's just $2 a month. $2! That is less than most Patreons, and you get so much more bang for your buck. And now on to the show. First up is controversies and nontroversies, or as I like to think of this segment for the time being, Notes from Hollywood's Collapse. As someone who followed the spread of coronavirus through China and into South Korea, I wish I could say that I was terribly surprised by what we are seeing in the United States. The entire domestic box office gross, by the way, you guys, on Wednesday, was $300,000, down from $11 million on the same last year. I wish I could say I was surprised. I'm not surprised. More surprising is the swiftness with which theatrical exclusivity has basically ended. Universal struck first, announcing plans to put The Hunt, The Invisible Man, and Trolls 2 on video on demand early. Very early in the cases of The Hunt and The Invisible Man. Those were not supposed to be on VOD for, in the case of The Hunt, at least 2 more months, and in the case of Invisible Man, probably a month, month and a half, something like that. And without any theatrical exclusivity at all for Trolls 2, which may be a boon to parents or a curse, depends on how much you like those movies.
Trolls World Tour.
Yeah, Trolls World Tour, whatever it's called. The other studios followed suit with announcements that Bloodshot, The Way Back, and similar titles that had been in theaters for a little bit then had all the theaters shut down on them, would hit VOD in fewer days than the 74 it usually takes. Kino Lorber announced that virtual theater rooms for their films would be set up as a way to help prop up indie theaters. It's not exactly VOD, it's just kind of VOD, but it also gets some money to the indie cinemas that need it in this difficult time. Streamers all over are prepping for an influx of content. There's already whispers that Warner Brothers may debut Wonder Woman on their new HBO Max service, and you know, maybe they'll release the Snyder Cut. Who knows? Maybe we'll finally get the Snyder Cut. I'm just saying. Alyssa, all of this raises a very important question. Is the theatrical experience done forever?
I hope not. Despite the fact that we spend a lot of time watching stuff with bad CGI and poorly calibrated sound or color in the theater, it's still one of the most valuable communal experiences that we have. And in fact, especially in the United States, where we seem to disagree on everything except maybe the Marvel Cinematic Universe, it's one of the few places left where we can come together, have a common experience, sort of regardless of who we are. And I would hate to lose
that. I think DC fanboys like Sonny actually disagree a lot about the Cinematic Universe.
Well, I mean, it depends on what we're talking about. I think Marvel's brand of quality is, you know, very steady.
Yeah.
For what it's worth. But this is neither here nor there, unless, of course, Marvel decides to just say F it and put Black Widow on Disney Plus. What do you think, Peter? What are the odds of that happening?
Well, I think that's really the big question right now, because it looks like nearly everything that isn't at that level is going to end up on a streaming service, video on demand, somehow or another, right? And when I say at that level, I mean really big global billion-dollar tentpole films that are designed to support a studio for the better part of a year, and that's stuff like Mulan, Black Widow, it's the Fast and the Furious films. And all of those are kind of in a really interesting bind right now, just because they rely so much on grosses from China, which of course has had its theaters shut down for quite a while, in addition to grosses from the United States. And so in some ways, they really need to open theatrically. They need those theatrical revenues because they're built around that model. And in other ways, they are the ones that are going to have to make the toughest choices in terms of maybe of saying maybe we are not going to do that. And so you can look at a film like The Hunt, which we're going to talk about a little later. It's in some ways kind of a classic video on demand, direct to DVD film. It's a kind of a grindhouse sort of, you know, fairly low budget, cheap looking slasher movie in a lot of ways. That sort of thing is going to play fine on VOD. If I spent a lot of time in video stores as a kid, as I think you did, Sonny, in Blockbusters, in network video. And it was always interesting to me to talk to the clerks, some of whom were my friends, about what did really well on video. And it was always like movies that didn't do well in the theaters. And it's, again, the big movies that did really well in the theaters would then, of course, play well on video. But you would have things like Baby Geniuses, which, you know, my local network video had something like 50 copies of, all of which were rented out for weeks at a time. It was a movie that was difficult to get. Baby Geniuses, who remembers that movie? And so there is this weird sort of market where films like The Hunt, films like Bloodshot, stuff like Invisible Man, which was made for $7 million, those movies are going to be pretty natural fits. And that's not going to be true for these mega budget films. And yet, they don't have a home anymore.
I think part of the problem, that's a weird
situation to be in.
But part of the problem for the entertainment industry is that production on everything has shut down as well and seems likely to remain shuttered for a while. A movie set is a great place to pass a virus between people who have a lot of closed content. And so because the pipeline is down, if people just hold theatrical releases instead of pushing them out on video on demand, they risk having a period at some point where like people just don't have new stuff to watch. And I mean, to be fair, we're in a huge sort of glut of television production. Maybe everyone will go and catch up on all of the supposedly sort of Silver Age TV that they haven't watched yet. But
yeah, this solves the peak TV problem in a kind of horrible way, right?
But yes, but the concern, I think, for the movie industry in particular is that if you don't give people something new for a long time, they switch over to television. They, you know, like video gaming finally becomes the sort of mass cultural experience that it's always sort of been in the background, but that has never quite sort of broken out into mainstream criticism and conversation and everything else. I mean, there's a new Doom game out that is grabbing a lot of the cultural conversation. And so the choice for the studios with the big blockbusters are sort of, do you give up the advertising campaign that you put together around this? Do you give up sort of the opportunity and the lock on people's attention? Or do you sacrifice the box office revenue for the sake of keeping people just engaged with the movies?
I think that theaters are still closed at the beginning of July, we're going to start seeing very large budget tentpole films being put on demand somehow or another, maybe not as part of streaming services, as part of the package, but for a fee, perhaps even a quite large one. I think that by July and maybe earlier by July, we will see that if theaters are still closed in large parts of the country, which seems like a possibility.
Yeah. Although China is planning on reopening.
Well, China's already reopening. Yeah. I mean, China's reopening some theaters. You actually saw some of the movie stocks have some of the movie theater company stocks have a bounce back this last couple days as these theaters in China have started to reopen. You know, there's also, I think, it is worth thinking about the actual consumer behavior here, because it's one thing to say like, okay, well, the studios are going to put out, you know, these movies on demand and they're going to be pretty expensive. You know, the Hunt is $20 and The Invisible Man is $20 to rent. The Way Back will be $20. Bloodshot, I think, is $20 to own, not just to rent, which is a slight tweak on this, but kind
that's
of the same.
That's a steal.
But you know, I think we have to actually really think about this. Like, how many people are going to be willing to spend $20 to watch something at home when it's probably going to be available on streaming in some form, you know, 90 days from now. Or it's going to be available to rent for, you know, $4 90 days from now, right?
Well, like, maybe that's the new window is that system, right? The old window system was that theaters got it first and then had their 3 or 4 months. And that window has collapsed somewhat, has shrunk over the course of the last couple decades. But it still exists. And maybe the new window is it goes to a kind of pay a fee system, you know, $20 or even I can imagine, you know, the new Christopher Nolan movies or Marvel movies coming out and being even more than that. And then 6 months later there's a guarantee that they won't be on streaming services for 6 months. I think that this is going to, if this persists for a long time in the United States, and by a long time, I mean 3, 4, 5, 6 months, I think that this is really going to radically change the distribution models for Hollywood in ways that are somewhat hard to predict right now. And I think that movie going as we know it will go away. Not the entire theatrical experience, but the kind of regular weekend matinee, $9 and popcorn experience that a lot of people have come to expect. And that what will be left will be a sort of rarefied experience, you know, a little bit like buying vinyl for music nerds, where people who are really into it will have really high quality luxury theaters and will pay a lot more for the experience. But most people will just end up watching things at home. And I think there's a couple of reasons for this. One is it's going to be hard to reopen the theaters just logistically and in terms of for legal and risk reasons. So the theaters may stay closed longer than they strictly have to. Two is it's going to train people to watch movies at home and they're just going to get used to it. Three is even if theaters do reopen, I think that while there will be some people, perhaps like me, who rush to go back to theaters to kind of get that experience again of the communal experience, there's going to be people who are anxious and who are worried about going out, and then you have the pipeline issue. And if productions stay closed for 3, 4, 6 months, even longer, then it's going to be really hard to reopen theaters with what content? Yes, there's some stuff that might end up kind of in stock, back stock that they could reopen with, but this is an existential crisis for theatrical distribution. I don't think for movie making writ large, but for the theatrical experience as we know it, I think is quite likely to just be permanently scarred and changed when we come out of this.
I really hope that that's not true. I mean,
me too. I hope I'm wrong. I really hope I'm wrong.
I mean, I do. You know, when James Holmes shot up a screening of The Dark Knight, I was really worried that that was going to be the end for theatrical distribution, that people would just not want to go sit in the dark with a bunch of strangers and deliberately choose to let down their wariness. And fortunately, that was not the case. People kept going to the movies. People were willing to accept that risk. But it is very different when the risk is sort of one person with a poisonous ideology and possible mental health issues who decides to shoot up a theory, and when everyone's potentially a risk. And so I don't know. I'm really worried. So at my day job, I write and edit stuff at the Washington Post, and I'm editing a column by Christopher Nolan as we, you know, around taping this podcast. And he starts by talking about this chain of movie theaters that's based out of Missouri and that grew out of like two separate chains owned by two separate families, one of which did theatrical distribution, one of which basically put on like traveling drive-ins. And it's been around since 1924. The families intermarried. The company was ultimately merged in 1980. And they laid off 2,000 people and closed 418 theaters that served communities in the Midwest and Southwest. And, you know, there's a huge loss there. There's the loss of the national cultural conversation. There's the loss of the jobs and income. And there's a loss of history. And the idea that that might be permanent is really devastating. I mean, we think of movies as this incredibly important art form, but we basically had them as a mass market medium for 100 years. And that doesn't feel like enough.
All right. Well, that's really depressing. Let's move on to the main attraction, which is a real uplifting story. This week, we're looking at the last movie I happened to see in the theaters and the first movie to break the VOD barrier, The Hunt. It is the most controversial movie that no one has seen. The premise, which basically entails globalist elites hunting redneck deplorables for sport, came under fire first from the libs, who wondered if these violent delights were what we need in this age of mass shootings, and then from the cons, who misunderstood the whole idea and thought it was a movie about how it is good to hunt right-wingers for fun. The Hunt isn't high art exactly, or at all, but if you're up for a movie about how both sides of the cultural divide are annoying and slash or kind of terrible, and if you really just want kind of a grindhouse, nihilistic, let's blow up some heads for fun, The Hunt is the movie for you. I have to say, I have not laughed harder in theaters than I did when one of the elites, in between butchering the deplorables, squealed with delight when Ava DuVernay liked one of his posts. It was just like this kind of pitch-perfect specific joke about the ridiculousness of certain people and the bubbles they kind of find themselves in. Peter, as a libertarian, I want to ask you this question. I assume that you are totally fine with hunting the humans for sport, but only if they agree to be hunted, right? That is like the line of demarcation here.
I think you've figured out libertarianism, just like everybody else has it figured out, Sonny. Who else would know what libertarians are like besides a neocon warmonger like yourself?
Exactly. Gotta know your enemy.
There is this weird thing that I've been thinking about, which is that The Hunt, as with you, The Hunt is quite likely to be the last movie I see in the movie theater at the bare minimum for a really long time. And The Hunt was, of course, a movie that was canceled, that is about cancel culture. And that is, you know, does a sort of fine enough, reasonably amusing job of satirizing both sides. It does a pretty good job of giving you somebody to root for while not in any way taking sides, because it basically views everyone as terrible, which is a perspective I can get behind in certain ways. But it's also
zero Pinocchios.
It also just is a reminder in some ways, seeing that, having that be the last movie that I see in theaters. Again, for I think at least a couple of months and quite possibly much longer than that, is a reminder of how frivolous and silly all of those debates about cancel culture kind of were now that movies are actually canceled. Like, really, there's no movies anymore. I mean, that's a slight exaggeration, but we're now in this sort of awful situation where, at least in, you know, a lot of the big cities, movie theaters are closed. They're closed all throughout the country. Even, you know, at least one of the big chains has closed everywhere. And it's really sort of, it kind of sets in relief how small and how petty those concerns were. I didn't hate the movie. I liked bits of it. It's a moderately effective satire. And if you like, you know, if you like the old gory grindhouse films and have some kind of soft spot in your heart for them, as I do, it does a good enough job there. But it's also the movie is. I wish there were more to it. I don't think it sort of fully lives up to its promise. I'm curious what Alyssa, who is probably not an old school grindhouse fan, thinks of it.
Yeah,
Alyssa, how could you have guessed?
What did you make?
What
did you make of this?
Mostly, this movie annoyed me because I thought it was a huge waste of Betty Gilpin, who is an actress I kind of love. I don't know if either of you have watched Glow, Jenji Cohen's like 1980s like lady professional wrestling drama. But in that, she plays a woman whose husband cheats on her with her best friend, who ultimately recruits her to join this wrestling league, and they become like the sort of core narrative antagonists in the show. And it's a really interesting performance, in part because she plays this woman who is really beautiful, smarter than she's been given credit for, but whose body has always been treated as sort of like a decorative ornament. And when she gets in the ring, she finally gets to sort of work out all of this aggression that she has tamped down kind of in favor of being a nice girl for years. And it's just like, she's got a lot of range. And watching The Hunt, just like it, the movie keeps her face in the same sort of perpetually downturned expression the entire time. Like, it's a nice showcase for the fact that, like, she could be a pretty good action actress if, you know, someone gave her a higher profile role in which to do it. But she's like, she's better than the material here. And that's kind of a bummer because I like her. I also think it's sort of a mistake to, like, not set up her and Hilary Swank as antagonists earlier in the movie. But, like, by keeping them apart until their final sort of kitchen domestic catfight, you kind of, I mean, I think you kind of miss out on what some good sort of crackling chemistry and also kind of the central point, right? Which is that Hilary Swank's character thinks that Betty Gilpin's character has, like, unfairly attacked her on the internet. But in fact, she's wrong about, like, she's got the wrong person, essentially.
And are we certain she has the wrong person? Didn't the movie introduce at least a little bit of ambiguity about whether maybe, I wouldn't say a lot, but, like, it leaves open the possibility that actually maybe she is the right person and just decided to deny it, which I thought was kind of interesting, that it didn't quite ensure her innocence. It said it seemed to suggest she's probably innocent. That's probably the best reading, but maybe not.
But I mean, it's just the question.
No, that was not my read on it.
The question,
honestly.
The question becomes just, like, so ephemeral because it's, I mean, it's just barely there, right? I mean, I rarely say that a movie should be longer, but if this movie actually wanted sort of to, like, flesh out its convictions in any way, like, you could have done 15 minutes of sort of character development and exposition throughout the movie. It would not have been that hard.
See, I don't really think it needed to be longer or to have more exposition, in large part because I think the whole point here is that these are just caricatures. I mean, like, this is a sort of a 99% wish fulfillment thing, right? This is the sort of thing that everyone can look at and say, God, everybody who is not me is very, very annoying. And that goes for both sides. That goes for, like, the kind of hyper woke NPR listening, people, and then the podcasters who talk about the crisis babies. The crisis babies line was another one that made me, like, actually laugh out loud in the theater.
Yeah,
which was awkward because both times I kind of, like, guffawed in laughter. I was the only person to laugh, so I felt slightly alone there. And I did see it. There were, like, six other people in the theater. I mean, I assume we all have coronavirus now, but who can say with the lack of testing? I don't know. Do you guys think that just in terms of the thematic content that it was too weak-kneed or too both sides-y? This is the complaint I've heard from all of my liberal friends who have seen it. Like, well, it's not really fair because some things are worse than other things, and this movie treats all things as equally bad.
I think that it is fine. I think that that perspective is fine for a movie that is obviously a broad and cartoonish satire to kind of render everything as equally stupid and equally awful. However, I don't think the movie did nearly as good a job as I wish it would have at actually exploring that view. Instead, what it just does is it caricatures everyone, turns them all into kind of easy cartoons, and says, well, here's one that you can kind of like because she sort of sees all, she kind of, she's, it's not even that she rejects it or sees it or has any, she's just above it and wants to get out of it and save herself. Right? Like, and that's,
but that's
just
the only
just
sane
not
way
much
to live.
Of a, but it's just not much of a perspective. It's not even exactly a wrong one. It's an insufficient one. It's a little bit shallow. It's a little bit thin. And you know what? This is a kind of Roger Corman-esque grindhouse political satire. So maybe I'm expecting too much. But I think there are movies of that caliber, and you can look at stuff like Romero's Living Dead films, which are, the politics are very left, But you can look at movies like the like those, and you can say, well, they are low budget, trashy, gory horror films, but they have actually quite rich thematic perspectives. And they manage to explore their ideas, not just sort of say, nah, 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 everybody is stupid.
No, but they just say one side is stupid. I mean, this is did you guys, I don't know if either of you guys saw the Black Christmas remake.
No.
The thing about the Black Christmas remake, the way I described it on Letterboxd is basically if you took a million progressive tweets and fed it into an AI, the most annoyingly kind of progressive sort of tweets, right, about identity politics and all that stuff, and you had it spit out a script, that's what it would look like. And the problem with Black Christmas isn't necessarily that it relitigates all sorts of dumb internet fights, like, for instance, whether or not Camille Paglia is sufficiently feminist. That's like a thing that happens in this movie. And I was like, I remember that fight from 3 months ago on Twitter. Sure. You know, or 18 months ago on Twitter, whenever it happened. But the
time is over, guys. No, more time.
Yeah, yeah, there's no time. There's just the now.
Along with movie theaters and cocktail bars, time has been canceled.
Yeah, but like Black Christmas annoyed me in a way because it was stereotypical and flat and kind of in one direction. And I do kind of, there's actually something kind of subversive about the both sidesism here, because you just don't really see it.
Yeah.
In big, even like modestly budgeted Hollywood pictures like this. I mean, it is a unique thing. And again, I go back to the reaction from some of my liberal colleagues who were all like vaguely upset about it. Not like angry, or, you know, they were just like, it wasn't funny enough. And really, both sides aren't as bad as the other. So it's not fair. And I was like, you want fair? Like, no offense, guys, but, you know, fair is not a thing that I am looking for in the movie theaters, because it's not something I ever get.
You know what it reminded me of? Just actually, Alyssa, go ahead. But
I actually thought the satire of sort of the way liberals talk to each other is pretty funny, right? Like the scene in the fake convenience store where, you know, the woman's calling out her husband for saying, you know, like those people, and then they're having a debate about whether it's more politically correct to say black or African American, like. That, I mean, that's pretty well done. The scene in the bunker where they're sort of picking through the various people to hunt. Like, that stuff is reasonably well executed. I think, though, that there's sort of a mismatch between... A
lot of execution in this movie. A lot of execution.
Yeah. Groan. Man, we're only like 5 days into social distancing, man. I don't know what your dad humor is going to be like when we're done with this, but a little worried.
Bad.
It's going to be so funny that I'll mysteriously have kids.
but there's a sort of weird mismatch between the satire and the concept, right? I mean, the idea that it's like part of what I think, and speaking as someone who, you know, I represent the liberals in this scenario, I live in, you know, a big urban liberal enclave. I think my sense is that some of what drives conservatives crazy about a certain subset of liberals is the sense of sort of contempt and distance. And it doesn't, the leap that these characters make from like, they said it about us, so we're going to make it true. I mean, like, I get that that's the concept, but it doesn't totally work as the satire, because I don't think that is sort of what the dynamic is in liberal circles as much. It's like there is not a like drinking conservatives tears culture in the same way there is a culture of like owning the libs. And so I think it sits a little unevenly to me as a satire, despite the fact that I felt like some of the satires of just the way that liberals talk and try to one-up and impress each other felt like those dynamics were captured fairly well, but like the overall mechanism didn't feel like as good a satirical match to me.
Peter, just I want to jump in one thing here before I let you finish up. The one disagreement I would have with you there, Alyssa, is that I do think that there is a sort of, I think there is a sort of sneering contempt in this movie that the liberals have for the conservative figures. In the there was a line I didn't have my notebook with me, so I couldn't jot it down, but it was something like, "Who cares? He was probably a racist anyway, right? Or he probably says the N-word, and he probably says it on Twitter." And it was like, it's like this assumption that everyone who thinks a certain way, acts a certain way, and conforms to the worst ideas that you have about that subset, so it is okay to treat them as less than, is, I think, I do think that there is an accuracy to that critique of liberal culture that is fairly spot on.
But I do think that in a weird way, the like, well, they, you know, they said that we're like this or that we're doing this, so we're going to do it for real, is like, I think that dynamic is much more culturally accepted on the right, that like, we're going to own the libs, we're going to lean into being deplorables. Like, I mean, I agree with you about some of this contempt and sort of assumption building, but the idea of specifically of sort of leaning into the worst thing that people say about you, I think is, well, I think that is just more established as part of sort of at least the alt-right culture, than it is any liberal subculture at the moment.
Yeah. I mean, I think part of the thing here, though, I do think there's an element of plot mechanics to this.
Yeah. Oh, 100%.
Also, that's like, no. It's like, we need to get them to a place where we hunt them. All right, Peter, we're running long here. Let me let you wrap up.
Yeah. So
with your thoughts on the hunt.
The final twist, which is that they decided to do this because they had made a joke and then somebody had thought, well, had turned it into a conspiracy theory, is a way for the movie to say, I agree with Alyssa, a little bit awkwardly, but it's a way for the movie to say that both sides are making the other side worse, and they are allowing themselves to be made worse by their own choices, and by allowing themselves to be manipulated by the stuff that the other side does that you find irritating. And I think it's a sort of interesting, it doesn't pull it off particularly quite as well as I would want it to, but it is, I think the movie is in some ways, it's the most interesting idea in the movie, is that everybody is being made, allowing themselves to be made worse by the worst behaviors of the other side, which are in some ways real, but which you could avoid by ignoring. And in some ways, the movie is a really, it actually sort of takes after Damon Lindelof's last project, Watchmen, which is the most recent example of a kind of, we're going to not pick sides type movie or type show that I can think of. Because in the end, it sort of says that, that both the racist conservatives and the woke liberals who want to sort of remake the world in their image, who want to use force to sort of to push everyone else to be the way that they think that the world has to be, right? The authoritarians on both sides are wrong, and instead what we are left with are individuals who have to make the choice to be better themselves. And Watchmen pulls this off much more artfully. Watchmen is, I think, one of the great pop culture works of the last few years, right? It's really, really well done. I think The Hunt isn't nearly as well done, but it works from a similar kind of idea, which is that, the worst people on both sides are going to try and force everyone else to do what they think, to be the way that they think they should be. And instead, it's just your responsibility, you an individual, to be better and to be above this. And I guess, I guess I kind of appreciate that, even if I don't think that it worked quite as well here.
Okay, so what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on The Hunt?
For $20, rent The Invisible Man instead.
That's not a thumbs up or thumbs
down. It's a thumbs down.
Okay.
I say rent Peter. Both. The Invisible Man's a better movie, but I say rent both. Thumbs up.
I will give it a thumbs up. I do think that it is not going to be to everyone's taste, but I had quite an entertaining time. All right, that brings us to assigned viewing. Alyssa, why are we watching Outbreak? Does it have anything to do with current events?
We are watching Wolfgang Peterson's Outbreak, which came out in 1995, mostly because we want to set up to discuss Steven Soderbergh's vastly better pandemic movie, Contagion, next week. Outbreak is a sort of supremely weird movie and very, very much of its 1995-iness. It stars Dustin Hoffman as Sam Daniels, a gung-ho army doctor who is called in to investigate a monkey-born, incredibly fast-moving yet extremely lethal, despite the fact that those two parts of epidemiology are in conflict with each other, virus that infects a small town, and in the process of investigating it, he finds out that the army, represented mostly here by Morgan Freeman's General Billy Ford and Donald Sutherland's General Donald McClintock, plan to bomb the town into oblivion because they want to use a strain of the weapon as a virus. This is a plot about as smart as some of the crazed conspiracy theories we're hearing about COVID-19 now. Yeah, it's kind of a trip. I had not watched this in a while, and I had forgotten the weird combination of sort of conspiratorialism and really extreme sentimentality of it. It's a ridiculous movie, but it might make you feel slightly better that it doesn't seem like we're gonna nuke a small town.
Alyssa, I'm with you. I had totally forgotten how like crazy, how like kind of rabidly anti-military this movie was, like kind of hilariously like stuck in post-Vietnam syndrome anti-military. it is a fascinating cultural document, and to think
so, right?
No. I don't hate this movie because it has certain charms. Among them, the fact that the cast is like one of the best casts I can remember seeing on screen together all at the same time.
Yeah,
it's got
Dustin Hoffman,
Morgan Freeman, Donald Sutherland, Rene Russo, Kevin Spacey, Cuba Gooding Jr., and even that doctor from Grey's Anatomy who dies.
Patrick Dempsey is Jimbo Scott.
Yeah, that guy. But it's a fascinating the whole last third of the movie is so ridiculous and so like weirdly action adventure-y, and also just watching it now, I mean, look, who knows what will happen over the weekend by the time this podcast airs, but like watching it now where the military has to roll into this little town and like put everybody under martial law and they're like hitting people in the head with the butts of their rifles and they're like, you get back in your homes.
Isn't that what Bill de Blasio is calling for, basically, right now? Bill de Blasio, the world should be more like the third act of Outbreak, right?
Yeah, I just watched that, and I'm like, well, that's not what's happening. I don't know. Peter, what'd you make of it?
I kind of love this movie. It's not a good representation of what life under a national, global pandemic is like, and in some ways because it takes place, the disease is very different, right? It moves a lot faster, it kills 100% of people, and at least for the purposes of this movie, it's effectively localized to a single California town, so in some ways you would expect the reaction to a different type of virus to be different, but what I love about this movie is how deeply it captures all of the things that were like all of the kind of common elements of big picture 90s cinema, right? It's not actually based on a Michael Crichton story, or Michael Crichton had nothing to do with this, but that's sort of surprising. Instead, it's based on Richard Preston's The Hot Zone, and it's just one of these sort of thrillers that takes a scientific premise and has a bunch of, clearly somebody did a bunch of scientific research and looked at how the CDC does this sort of thing, and probably went into did a little tour, or at least talked to somebody who had worked there, and then of course it uses that to tell a story that is completely ridiculous and has nothing to do with the science or the way the government works or the way sort of any of this stuff actually rolls out, because that would be boring. That would be uninteresting. And we're going to see next week when we talk about Soderbergh's film that that's actually not true. But it just has all of these hallmarks of the kinds of, sort of not quite big, but like large budget, star-driven thrillers that were the bread and butter of a lot of studios in the 1990s that I grew up watching all the time and that don't really get made anymore. I was thinking about this. If you wanted to make a movie like this right now, you would it would almost certainly have to go on HBO or on FX. It would be 6 or 8 or 10 episodes, right? And it would be probably a little less of an action movie in the end. It would focus a little more on kind of the conspiracy aspects. It would be a social thriller. You know, you'd spend more time kind of investigating the CDC bureaucracy. Obviously, I mean, if you made this movie 3 months ago, because now if you tried to make it, well, first of all, the productions are shut down. But second of all, we've learned a little bit more about what the world looks like with a pandemic. But just in terms of like how this type of story would be rolled out to viewers now, it would be a very different sort of experience. And there's just not, you know, it's hard to think of a filmmaker like Wolfgang Petersen who made, you know, this came out in 1995. 2 years earlier, he made In the Line of Fire, a Clint Eastwood, John Malkovich thriller about, you know, somebody who's trying to assassinate the president. A couple years after Outbreak in 1997, he made Air Force One. After that, he made The Perfect Storm. And so The Perfect Storm is a pretty CG heavy film. There's some CG sequences with the airplanes at the end of Air Force One, but these are movies that aren't driven by big special effects so much as they are stunts, stars, and concepts. And that's something that we don't see nearly as much, certainly at the big budget studio level, in Hollywood anymore. And so I enjoyed it just because it was a kind of a time warp back to a different Hollywood and a different era of filmmaking.
Well, and it's also interesting in that it's very much a romantic drama, right? I mean, one of the big through lines is that Dustin Hoffman's character is getting divorced from Rene Russo's character. And they're sort of like competing epidemiologists. Like, he works for the military, she's at the CDC. And, you know, the epidemic ends up bringing them back together. And the scenes about their divorce and reconciliation are so cheesy. I mean, they're ridiculous. But at the same time, I mean, it's a movie about adults that make space for them to like argue and talk about their relationship and for them to be both accomplished professionals. And that's kind of a throwback too.
Did that remind you guys of The Abyss? Because it seemed to me like it was almost exactly lifted from the Ed Harris, I'm now just forgetting the actress's name, but from the central kind of relationship between two divorced people in The Abyss, which is another movie from innovative in its CGI, but another movie from that era that sort of works similarly in being big budget for its time, has a bunch of action and a bunch of effects, but is really driven by star and by premise and by script. And there's actual attempts at, I wouldn't say great writing, but at good writing and at writing lines that will be memorable and dialogue that will be memorable, even if it is a little over the top and kind of ridiculous.
Yeah. It's a lot of movie. and if you just want to watch people chew scenery for a couple of hours, you could definitely do worse, but it's a trip.
Yeah. All right. Next week's assigned viewing will be Deepwater Horizon, which we will watch to prepare for the Peter Berg, Mark Wahlberg team up Spencer Confidential. That is a Netflix original. You're going to be getting a lot of Netflix originals here, folks. So strap in. We are entering weird times. Please go to rebellermedia.com and sign up for a membership. If you don't sign up, we don't get to keep doing this. And remember, for the next 2 months, it's free. There's a little box at the top of the site with a link to the deal. I think we're also going to put a link in the description of this episode of the podcast. So hopefully you will be able to see it there. Click, sign up. It's a pretty good deal, guys. If you love the show, tell your friends. A strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow a podcast. And if we don't grow, we die. We're kind of like sharks. Review us at Apple. Give us, you know, 5 stars and all that stuff. If you didn't love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter at Slutty Bunch. I've got nothing to do but be on Twitter all day while I try to keep my 1 and 4-year-old from killing themselves in the home. I will convince you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys next week.
Across the Movie Aisle is a Rebeller Podcast Network original, hosted by Sunny Bunch, Alyssa Rosenberg, and Peter Suderman. Produced by Sunny Bunch and Natasha Pasetta. Executive producer, Dallas Sonier. Associate producer, Jessica Safavamare. Art and design by Jason Koslerich. Sound recording, design, and mixing by Sunny Bunch, with music by James Malone.